Before Alan says anything, I always want to get a word in.
Enough.
It's important to ask questions. And when questions come up along the way, don't be reluctant. Raise your hand, stand up, and Alan will either address it in the conversation or tell you just a second, and he'll continue. My job is to help you hear details, because I think details make things real. So he may say, I was caught. Well, where were you caught and what was that like? And those are the kinds of things that if you've got questions, ask him. And he's not shy, as you can tell.
I'd like to dedicate this afternoon to Heather Heyer.
Sometimes we get choked up over... get choked up. And I'm sure you all know who she was.
At any rate, I try to prepare for today. Obviously, I have no need to try and memorize my story, but I was shocked when I looked at the web. looked at the web and I saw what happened here. I was just flabbergasted. And then I was alerted that in my own alma mater, and a place where I was taught, University of Florida in Gainesville, some similar thing happened. But Gainesville was forewarned by what happened here. And the students were much more aggressive and much more proactive. And it did not go as badly as it went here. So in any event, we are living in difficult times at best. Dangerous times, I think, is a better expression. The reason I was so shocked and the reason I'm moved right now, because as I listened to the rhetoric, I heard almost exact verbiage of what I heard in Europe when I was a child and before. The language was identical. So that to give you a sense of my fear, when the Nazis, when Hitler took control of Germany, and he took control lawfully, according to the laws of Germany, the total percentage of population that were Nazi supporters or Nazis or Nazi sympathizers was a grand total of 6%. I suspect that if you combine all of the extremists here in the United States today, the percentage might be quite a bit higher than the 6%. And that's just to give you a little bit of a sense that what I feel, what I fear. I often speak to schools, to youngsters, and invariably I ask them the question, and I ask you the same question now. Can it happen here? Can it happen now? Now, when young people, when I speak to them, I am amazed, and I think our teachers do a terrific job. Almost invariably, the heads start nodding, and they're right. So why am I speaking to you candidly? Hopefully to inoculate you, to make you alert, to make you aware. The first time that you choose not to register, not to vote, you're turning off over the power to exactly the people that you would not want to. You're entrusting your lives and the lives of your children and their successors to precisely the people that you would not want to do, to address the house, him included. That's why I speak. For me, I had almost an idyllic childhood for the first 4.5 years of it. My dad was an insurance executive in Poland, in Krakow, southern Poland. My mother was a professional violinist. We lived in a very nice neighborhood, not at all segregated. My playmate was a little Christian girl. My grandmother and grandfather lived down the block, literally, and so did my aunt. If I wanted something between my grandma, grandpa, my parents, and my aunt, I could easily get two of anything. Life was good. We would vacation at the seashore. I tell you how good life was, just to give you a sense. My dad's parents came to New York in the mid-30s because they had two sons living in New York, just to check it out. And they thought, well, maybe it'll move to the United States. They spent 3 weeks or thereabouts in New York City, and they went right back to Poland. Life was better in Poland than here in the United States. And that gives you a sense. And from that very, very positive, wonderful environment to hell on earth was a matter of days.
Alan, what impact, if any, do you think that early childhood upbringing and support had upon you?
I think it helped me maintain my sanity, because I had that first, not quite 5 years, 4.5 years of upbringing and psychological base. And even though the next, from 1939 to 1945, was very difficult, and it left lots of scars, nevertheless, that base was very, very helpful. And this is a word to all of you. I might say this. Every one of us reaches difficulty. I don't dare to move because I'm afraid of the audio. But
why don't you try moving and see what happens?
Okay, ordinarily I pace back and forth. Every one of you will have difficult moments in time. Every one of us experiences depression at one time or another. And I want to tell you, over the years I've seen psychologists and counselors and therapists and social workers anywhere from one session to a year and a half. And they kept me sane. Now, bottom line, I've had, I think, a very happy life, a successful life, a professionally rewarding life. I have a great family, and to a great extent, I attribute it to my teachers, and to a great extent, I attribute it to the mental health workers.
So, how about me?
And most of all, to my wife. About the war itself. My dad was a victim. I'm not sure. I think you resent that word. Anyway, he was subject to the quota system in Poland. And the problem there was, in Poland at the time the war broke out, about 11% of the population was Jewish. But many universities would not admit a Jewish person at all. And in addition to that, those that did, there was a 5% rigid quota. So my dad wound up going to a university in Vienna, part of the same school system, by the way, that Hitler went to, and spoke German brilliantly, had no problem whatsoever. He had two primary languages, Polish and German. And during much of the war, he passed as either an Austrian or a German. In order to accomplish that, he had what some of us might call a makeover. He went to a physician and said, you see this?
I think it's this that I'm okay. Staying too close.
Can somebody turn that mic off, possibly? Any chance? He went to a physician and said, my death warrant. Give me a nose job. The doctor said, I can't. To bring a Jewish person to a hospital, it was forbidden. They would shoot both of us. My dad said, well, do it at home. You got your little black bag. And the physician said, absolutely impossible. I don't have an assistant, I don't have anesthetic, I don't even have a full supply of surgical tools. My dad said, you know, if I can't survive, my wife has no chance whatsoever. She's dependent upon me. And the doctor thought for a while, the doctor was my dad's friend. And he said, I would love to help you, but I really can't. And then dad played his ace card. By that time I was 7 years old. He said, I have a seven-year-old son. I have a seven-year-old son. And if we don't make it, he has absolutely no chance of survival at all. This was true. So the physician, with great trepidation, said, come to my house tonight, and I can make you no promises, but I'll do the best I can. My dad did just that. His anesthetic was a half a bottle of vodka. He actually assisted the physician in a rhinoplasty, held a tray, which picked up the tissue, handed him tools from time to time. And the work product was marvelous. My father had a beautiful aquiline nose instead of a big bulbous nose. He looked different. And in order to complete the makeover, bleached his hair, and with his control of the German language, he socialized with Nazis. That's one of the ways that we survived. Mom and I were in hiding, and Dad would be out in the street, etc., trying to make a little bit of a living, bring food to us, and that was our mode of survival.
Alan, go back to the very start when your father said, we have got to leave.
Well, the first 20 months of our survival was really kind of much simpler than the rest of the story. In Krakow, we saw the Germans, we knew the Germans were coming. And so my dad said, we got to go east away from the Germans. And his hometown was Lviv, which is now in Ukraine. It's called now Lviv, easternmost Poland, now Ukraine. And so mom and dad are arguing back and forth until my dad resolved the argument. He grabbed me by the arm and started dragging me out the door, 4.5-year-old kid. I was the only child that they had. I was the only grandchild on my mother's side. And my mother was absolutely startled. She said, what are you doing? And his response was, I can't force you to go east, but I can take our son with me. My mother obviously would not let her child go. So crying and begging, she followed. And the only thing she asked for is, I want to say goodbye to my parents. And my parents were married probably 65 years or thereabouts. The only cruel thing I ever heard my dad say in 65 years, just once, he said, no, you can't say goodbye to your parents. And my mother was just crying, and she, at any rate, they left.
What did you leave with?
Nothing, just a stroller. And underneath the stroller, my mother had no time. She was just whatever she could grab. Underneath the stroller went a family album. On top of that was a chest of silver, which is most expensive, forks, knives, etc., silverware, which was the only thing she could think of because it was expensive. And on top of and then I was in the stroller, and on top of me was her fur coat in August in Poland, fur coat. At any rate, and we started walking. We came to a river, and none of the three of us could swim. So it was an impenetrable obstacle. But we heard that there was a ferry right up the river. So we went another 2 or 3 miles, and we walked. By the way, give you just a sense, we walked essentially the distance. I looked it up. I think from here to Raleigh. So we walked. And we came to this rectangular boat, and it was a horse wagon, horse attached to a wagon in the middle. On one side was a line of people, on the other side was a line of people. And in the back was a guy pushing the boat with a pole, and in front there was a rope strung across the river, and he was pulling us across the river. That's how we got across the river. Now, I would not waste your time with this detail, except that detail saved us for 20 months. Because when unknown to us, and any military person will tell you this, in a war zone, particularly if you're a civilian, you have no idea what's going on. It's mayhem. And so we did not know, but Poland was divided between Nazis and Soviets by an agreement that we never heard of. So we wound up on the other side of the river under Soviet domination, and while they weren't such nice folks either, they were not killing us. And so then we walked to Lvov from there, which was not very far, and we wound up with 20 months of life. Reasonably ordinary life. We got an apartment, we had, my dad got a job, and we were good.
Did you have family there?
My dad had his mother living there, and a brother and a sister. And that was very helpful. Fast forward to 1941, June of 1941, the Nazis approach. And the only people that the Soviets evacuated with them were folks that had strategic significance of some sort or another. We were left behind, and of course, the first thing that I remember, we got a little card, like a 3x5 card, saying you have to leave your apartment, leave everything in your apartment, and you go to this address. Well, we were so surprised, and you can only have one suitcase. We were so surprised when we went to that address, shock, there's another family living in that house, or in that apartment. We did the best we could, and then the shocks never stopped coming. Then the third family shows up. Folks, we never heard the word ghetto before. We were being moved into a ghetto. From that moment on, truly hell started. Very, very soon afterwards, Dad was walking home from work, and a friend of his, somebody he knew, I have no idea who it was, said to him, "You better get your 7-year-old son out of here because there's going to be a roundup of children." And Germans call it an action. My dad arranged for a farmer to give me shelter for a couple of weeks away from town, and a railroad worker in uniform to take me to a railroad, place me there, and then take me to the farmhouse. As we're walking towards the train station, a German truck pulled up, closed in off the end of the street. I saw the Germans jumping off the, I thought they were Germans. They were in uniform, jumping off the back of the truck. And I was the very first child taken in that action.
You described it so real to me as one end, you looked one end, they jumped off of the truck. You looked the other end, you jumped off of the truck.
The other end was also blocked off by another truck.
So yes. You were no way to...
I was the low-hanging fruit. I was a kid on the street. That was the first child taken. And they threw me on a truck. They fanned out into the apartments. If any of you have been to Europe, you know, the apartments are kind of congested, and there's usually in a courtyard. And I could hear people screaming and crying and begging as their children being wrestled away from them. These children, they came down with these children, threw them in a truck with me. And when the truck was full, or they deemed the truck to be full, they took us to a place. I have no idea where that place was. But they put us in a corral, and I managed to find a place right next to the barricade. There was a plywood barricade with a glass partition above it, and I could see, I was tall enough, I could see through the glass. Boy, was I happy when 2 or 3 hours later my dad showed up. I could see him because I saw through the glass. And my dad looked at me, our eyes locked. And he hesitated for a moment, then he went and talked to the commander of the facility, who was a German. They talked for a couple minutes. My dad, without looking at me again, turned around, walked out. And at this point, I was relatively sure that I was done, that I was going to die there. By the way, don't ever mistake what a young child knows and does not know. When that child's life is in danger, that kid will know even at the tender age of 7 or 8. At any rate, I kept my mouth shut. I didn't cause any trouble because I knew the consequences would be dire. And next thing I know, maybe several hours later, my dad comes back a second time, talks to the commandant again, and this time I saw the commandant turn on his heel and walk away. And my dad looked directly at me as I'm looking at this young lady and went just like this. And so I knew exactly what I needed to do. I joined my dad and we walked out of there. To this day, I can still see those children. And I think I'm the only one that survived from all those children. Almost immediately after that, we went into hiding.
What did your father do to get you out?
He bought me.
Well, how did he do that?
Well, he asked when he went to see the Nazi the first time. He said, I want to buy one of those children. How much? He was threatened, but my dad disregarded that. He said, how much? And he was two carats of diamonds and 2 ounces of gold. And when he left, it was to get the jewelry. He went to his sister, he went to his mother, he went to everybody who he knew, and in bits and pieces, an earring from one person, a ring from another, whatever, until he put it together. Came back the second time with jewelry in hand. Once again, he was threatened. He said, look at your hand. If you shoot me here and now, that's all you're ever going to get. But if he catches again, there's more for you. And that's when the Nazi walked away with loot in hand. After that, we went into hiding. Initially, we hid actually within the ghetto. We hid above a ceiling, between a ceiling and a roof. And subsequently, we hid underneath a factory. Whenever these hiding places became less than safe, at least what we deemed to be less than safe, then we would go to another, if we had another. Finally, we realized that in the ghetto, there was no place of safety, no refuge whatsoever. And so consequently, at that point, we decided that we will get false ID papers indicating that we were Christian and hide amongst the Christians. We did exactly that. We got false ID papers, and we would stay in somebody's home. Everybody was desperate for money. So people who had a spare bedroom would try to rent it out. So we'd stay in somebody's home for 2 days, and subsequently somebody else's home for 5 days. So maybe it was just 1 day in another person's home. And the reason why we kept them moving around was very simple. When somebody's staying in your house, clearly you want to know who that person is. You want to know something about them. They're in your house. So as long as the conversation was, where'd you go to school? Where were you born? Where do you live? Etc., etc. No problem. The moment the conversation shifted to, where do you go to church? Who is your favorite clergy? What services do you prefer over others? Now the conversation got dangerous for us. A single slip. If we say we like Pastor A versus Priest B, and Pastor A is deceased, so would we be. So at the moment the conversation got to anything that dealt with church, we were gone. That was a very successful strategy until one landlady got suspicious. And instead of telling us to leave, which we would have left immediately, she called the police. And so the police came and they said, we have a report that you might be Jewish. They didn't check. We'll take you downtown And we assume to the police station, which is not true. And we'll check it all out. And we went downtown. It took me about 60 years to find a building, but I did find it. It was a Gestapo headquarters. And for any of you here in this room who may be not Jewish, listen and listen well. The Germans never came out. We were sitting in the taxi cab with one of the two officers who made sure we did not run away. And the other one went inside for instructions. Could the Germans have established, ascertained, for sure, whether or not I was Jewish? Yes. Because in Europe at that time, in Poland at that time, the only people who circumcised their boy babies were Jews. Christians did not do that. So all they have to say is open and fly. Absolutely for certain. They didn't bother. And the reason I say you Christians listen, or you Muslims listen, well, Muslims are a little different, but you Christians listen. They didn't care. And what I'm trying to tell you is when the bad guys can't take control, all of us, without exception, are at risk. There is no safe harbor once the bad guys get control. So they said, take him across the street. Now to us, we had no idea what that meant. Across the street was a railroad station. It was called Umschlagplatz. For those of you who are German speakers, you know exactly what I'm saying. It means meeting place. It was no meeting place, it was a railroad station. And from that railroad station, the trains at that time were running to Treblinka. Anywhere from 1 to 3 trains per day. On each train, there were approximately 3,000 to 5,000 people. Now, when we came around the station, the place was almost empty. And a railroad station in Europe that's empty is unheard of. I venture to say, even tomorrow, you go to Europe, you go to a railroad station, any hour of day or night, there are people there. Place is empty. So the only thing I can figure is that a train just left with all the people on it. Yes, ma'am.
It was going to Treblinka. Would you describe Treblinka?
Well, yes. We went there. Well, subsequently, we looked at models, we looked at plans of it, etc. Treblinka oftentimes is mistakenly referred to as a concentration camp. That's an error. It was never a concentration camp. A concentration camp is a place where people are concentrated, where people work, etc. Now, there were also killing places in concentration camps. I understand all that. But essentially, it would be more than just a killing place. Treblinka was a murder factory. The only thing that took place in Treblinka was people, a train came, the women were sent to the left, the men were sent to the right. Each group went through a warehouse. Anything that you had on your holding a purse, a backpack, whatever, you put it in a pile. All that was sorted and sent to Germany. Then the next thing you were told is you had to take your clothes off because you were in a ghetto, you were on a train, you were dirty, you're going to go to showers. the ladies were subjected to one more indignancy, and that was long hair was sheared off right down to the scalp, and the hair was used for industrial purposes. Then in groups of 300 to 500, the people were ushered into a rectangular room, and overhead looked like there were shower heads, except the only thing that came through the pores in the shower heads was gas. And it took about 20 to 30 minutes for them to gas a batch of people to death. It was not an easy death. There are even recorded cases of people who had to be gassed twice or perhaps three times before they ultimately died. But everybody who went to Treblinka died. There were no exceptions. That's why I don't call it, it's not a concentration camp. There was no place there for people to sleep. There was no place there for people to eat. Everybody who entered Treblinka was supposed to be killed prior to the next sunrise. And the reason for that is, the camp had to be ready for the next load, for the next train load the following day. So they, those gas chambers had to work until whenever to be ready for next sunrise. The only reason I'm alive today is that the gas chambers, by the way, there were 800,000 people murdered there, if I remember correctly, in 16 months, 16 or 18 months. The only reason I'm alive today is because the gas chambers were far more effective than the burial brigade could be. And the bodies started mounting up. And there were actually mountains of bodies piling up. And the camp commander was afraid that the guards would get infected from the stuff emanating from the corpses. He stopped the trains to go into Treblinka for 5 days. I happened to get to the railroad station the first day of those 5 days. I know the day I actually went there. It was, I think, August 28th. I was in the railroad station waiting for a train to Treblinka for 2.5 days. The railroad station got more and more full. More and more people were waiting to go to Treblinka. It got to the point where it was shoulder to shoulder. And as at the age of 8 years old, I was a little bit rambunctious, and I would run around and disturb everybody. And so they took kids who were a little more active. they might call it obnoxious. And they sent us two by two, walking two by two, to the Warsaw Ghetto, to one of the 5 orphanages in the Warsaw Ghetto. I still know that I was not taken to the Korshak, the orphanage. I went to one of the others because I never crossed that infamous bridge. At any rate,
what was the Korshak orphanage?
Jan Korshak was a very famous man. He was a physician, was offered asylum many, many times, but he chose to go. But he also was in charge of an orphanage in Warsaw Ghetto, and he chose to go to death with his children rather than yet take up the safe harbor that was offered to him. At any rate, at that time, I was in the ghetto and in the orphanage, and my dad hired somebody or persuaded somebody, I don't know, to sneak me out of the Warsaw Ghetto.
What was it like for you in the orphanage?
I loved the orphanage. For the first time, I was with other children. I could play, I could run around, I could scream. The adults were very, very kind to me. It was the best time I had during the 5 years. But a man showed up and he said, I'm here to take you to your parents. Right. I didn't trust them. He was in a uniform. I didn't trust anybody in uniform. I didn't like him. I wanted to stay in the orphanage, and there was just no way he's going to get me out of there. Done. He spoke to me. He tried everywhere. He tried to persuade me. No, no, and absolutely no. Finally, he spoke to the adults in the orphanage, and I have no idea what he said to the adults, but next thing I know, and I love the adults, they took me by the hand, walked me out the front gate door or some door of the orphanage, and they thought they were coming out with me, but next thing I know, they slipped back inside, locked the door, and I'm stuck outside with this man that I really don't trust or like. And the first thing that this man did, we were outside, took a cap, pulled the brim way down, and he says, whatever you do, don't look up. Not a hard instruction. Secondly, don't say a word. Well, by this time, I've heard that for 2 years. I was well experienced in not saying a word. And lastly, hold my hand and don't let go. Okay. We walked down the main street of the Warsaw Ghetto, right up to the gate of the main gate of the Warsaw Ghetto. And a guard standing on the platform. And I'm looking at his boots. And he says, I don't look up. And he says, the guard looks down and he says, who are you? What are you doing here? And my guide, my savior, says, look at my uniform. I'm a railroad worker. Oh, I'm sorry, trolley car conductor. And I brought my son here to see these Jewish pigs. There's a pause, and the guard says, "You must be stupid, because it's almost curfew. And if the patrols catch you on the street after curfew, they shoot on sight." That's the way I was snuck out of the Warsaw Ghetto. Right in plain sight, right under the Nazis' noses. And the man was good to his word. He delivered me to my parents. Never saw him again.
Alan, your mother.
I wish to this day that I could thank him. But the only way that these people protected themselves is that they maintained their anonymity. So if the Nazis ever caught us, we could never give them up. We didn't know who he was. You were saying?
Your mother had been caught at the same time you
yes.
were.
Yes. She did something that was extraordinary. She volunteered to go into work detail. And while in the work detail, she bribed the guard, and he didn't look back, and she escaped. Told my dad where I was. That's how my dad was able to send this man into the orphanage. You know, knew which orphanage I was in, and they got me out alive. Again, several hundred children I was with. I suspect I'm the only one alive from that group. After that, my dad was hanging around with some Germans, and one of them was moaning and groaning and belly aching that he had an office, a two-room suite of offices. His company went out of business, and he was just forced to pay rent. And in a very nonchalant way, my dad said, "Well, I've got this little company. I can use that space. Why don't you sublet it to me?" And for the next 2 years, the only thing that happened in the office was my mother and I hid in the supply closet. That was it. It was a great place. Where are the Nazis not going to look for a Jewish person? In their own headquarters building. So,
what was the closet like? How big, and what did you do there?
It was a small closet. It was probably about this wide. In fact, I sat against one wall, my mother sat against the other wall, and there was not enough space, so our legs had to intertwine in order to get enough space. The only thing we had is, Mom and I had, each of us had a pillow on our lap, never once sat on it, and there was a Johnny, a little bucket we could use for personal needs, and the only other thing we had, bakers tie up a box of goodies with a white string. We had a bunch of that white string. And hour after hour, we would play cat in a cradle. That was the only way we could occupy our time. In 2 years' time, nobody ever looked in that closet, even though the security people came in, the maintenance people came in, until Warsaw Uprising. Not the ghetto. This was 14 months after the ghetto uprising. When the Polish people, the Russians were coming, and the Polish people wanted to liberate their own capital city. And so they fought off the Germans, and of course the Germans had overwhelming power. The Russians did not come. And so the Germans were back, regained control. And at that point, we had to leave there. Prior to that, this air raid warden insisted that we go down into the basement because he's the only one who opened the closet door. And we were in our basement hours at most a day. And the ground shook. We couldn't breathe. It was so dusty. And it turned out when the dust settled that there was a mega bomb in the cellar with us. Had it exploded, we would have been vaporized. But it was a dud. It didn't explode. But we had no idea whether it might explode later. And so we crawled on hands and knees under sniper fire to another a bomb shelter. And for me, now mind you, at this point I'm 9.5 years old. For me, something really scary happens. Like the rest of it wasn't scary at all. They separated my mother from me. And always I was as close to my mother as this young lady and I. I could always reach over and touch her. They separated my mother from me. And the next thing I know, they draped a sheet, a bed sheet, between us. My mother immediately knew that there would be, that this would upset me. And so she said from the other side of the sheet, "I'm okay, you're okay, nothing to worry about, don't worry," etc. Of course, I knew better, but I kept my mouth shut. That lasted for several hours. And then I heard something that I hadn't heard before, ever. Remember, I'm the only child. During the wartime, no babies were being born, nothing, etc. No animals around. Most of them at that point, all of them at that point, were eaten. And now I hear the screech of what I thought was a cat. Well, it was no cat. It was my baby brother announcing his entrance into his world. My brother's birth weight, less than 2 pounds. My mother had no breast milk. There were no women feeding other babies around. There was no chance this child would live. And it was such a novelty that a lot of physicians and nurses and midwives would come over to see this minuscule baby who was going to die. I mean, there was no question about it. One doctor, and I think he was, whether it was a smart aleck remark or a professional opinion, I have no idea. But he said to us, he said over his shoulder, walking out, "If you feel you have to do something for this baby, give him some sugar water." Now, the reason I denigrate that remark is because we hadn't seen sugar in 4 years. So to say, "Give him sugar water," was to me was an insane statement. However, within a matter of an hour or two, a bag of sugar showed up. And from that point forth, we could feed my brother less than a teaspoonful every half hour. And even if he was asleep, he would raise his head, pour a teaspoonful of sugar water in his mouth, and he would gurgle it down. Well, those of you who speak ill of Pepsi-Cola, Coca-Cola, and all the other colas, beware. Sugar water did keep him alive. And he's alive today and living in Miami, Florida, and practicing law. And I'm very proud of my brother, because you might want to look him up. His name is Andrew Hall. He has sued terrorist countries that sponsor terrorism all over the world. He gets huge judgments and then pursues the heck out of those countries to try to collect those judgments. And really, the hope is that if these people realize that there is risk in sponsoring terrorism, perhaps they'll be discouraged from so doing. At any rate, after that, this child that was going to be, at least my point of view, a clear nemesis, because we were passing by being invisible. And all of a sudden with a baby, you can't be invisible. So now we are highly visible, and I thought this child was going to cause our death. I was exactly wrong. Because a physician came, and by the way, we had no papers at this point, we were in the closet for 2 years. And a physician wanting to save the baby put us on a hospital train that took us out of Warsaw and to Krakow, the very place where we started. And in Krakow, we were hiding out with a number of other people who at that time were underground resistance workers. And 4 months later, in Krakow, we were liberated by the Soviets. And by the way, under the Soviets, we also had a great deal of difficulty, but that's a different story. And if you wish to know that story, you can have it for free, no charge. I'm serious. The printer charges us $20 per copy. I think it's usurious. So we make these available. Connor will be glad to send you a copy if you just sign up for it. And on the web, it's free. Do you have any questions? Is there anything you want to talk about? I guess we're done. Connor, you're in charge. Yes, ma'am. This is Connor Hargan. I know a lot of you know him, but you don't know him the way I know him. He is our grandson of choice. Now we have, no, seriously, we have four grandsons by birth, but then we have several others by choice, and he's the best of the lot. You were asking questions. Ah, I was trying to avoid that. I'll try to make it quick, because my dad was involved in underground activities. He got a job with the Polish government, and his background was in insurance. So right after the war, he started going west, trying to persuade insurance companies from London, from UK, and not just UK, but also from Switzerland, and wherever there were still insurance companies that were functioning, to set up offices in Poland, so that if somebody wanted to set up a plant there, they could ensure that plant would be not at risk. He made too many trips to the West, and he came under Soviet radar. Now, we saw the Soviets as our saviors, as our heroes. We had no idea what was coming. Middle of the night, they always came between 3 and 4 in the morning, banging on the door, and because my dad was a high government official, he got the high distinction that they let him take his pajamas off and put on his business clothes, and they dragged him off to prison. He was there for several weeks, asking for a hearing, asking what the charges were, asking why. And after several weeks, he was told he was going to be shipped to Siberia. Never there was a formal charge. And my mother knew that they kept the family as a guarantor for the prisoners, since the prisoner does misbehave or escape. And so my mother sent my brother and I walking across Europe, as Connor said, to get away from the Soviets. My dad, in fact, got a note saying at a certain time he'll be able to escape, as he did, and join my mother, and they went off to Paris from Poland. Then they had to find us, and I was hiding from everybody. But we got reunited. It took us about 6 months to get a fare from from Paris, actually London, to come to the United States. We arrived January 11th at LaGuardia about 9:30 p.m., and I can give you more detail. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. My mom, actually, more than you know. My dad, mom, and I, and my brother, all four of us survived. Yes, the nuclear family survived. But about six, maybe 4 months later, I was with my dad, and it must have been Saturday or Sunday. There's a knock on the door, and all of a sudden I see my dad's knees buckle. He staggers backwards, he's ashen gray. And I look outside the window, what's so scary? And I see a little old lady. And it was his mother. And she survived the war also.
And how did she survive?
She survived by posing as being deaf mute in the mountains. Her maid saved her, gave her heart. Her maid passed her off as her own grandmother. Yes, ma'am. Oh, on my mother's side, would you like, you want to know what's left of the family? You're looking at it. The family is totally wiped out. There is no, my brother and I are all that's left of that bloodline. Anybody else? Yes, sir. No, but let me just comment about that. When bad guys get control, when bad people gain control, at least my experience, there is no such thing as rule of law. There isn't. In other words, if they look at you, or you, or you, or you, or you, and decide they don't like you, they can pull out the gun and shoot you right there on the spot. Total impunity. So Even if that man would have been innocent, it made no difference. If they thought he was guilty, that's good enough. And by the way, if they shoot you on the spot, you got lucky, because other people were just tortured to death. Or they would take the entire family to a concentration camp. Yes, sir, bring it back. You know, there are, in every population, there are people who have an extraordinary moral compass. Now, even if the man was given a small fee, not only did he risk his life, but theoretically, they could have taken his entire family and wiped them out, concentration camp or otherwise. I cannot say to you how courageous some people were. I often wonder myself, do I have that kind of courage under those conditions? But there are exceptional people in every population. I've had the good fortune of meeting some. Yes? I'm sorry. But, and you next, I promise. Hold me to it. Yes, sir. That is the point I'm speaking to you today. That's exactly the reason I'm speaking to you.
Repeat the question, please.
Let me answer her question, and then you make sure I answer yours, because yours, that's the culmination of this whole talk. Everything else is a preparation for your question. Yes, yes, ma'am.
I was just wondering if you've been back to Poland, or to any of the places that you were as a child.
Yes, I went back to Poland 3 times. And about next month ago, fourth time. When my dad was alive, there was absolutely no way to go back. He would have been beside living, whatever the next step is beyond. My mother, I went back to Europe several times on business, etc. I persuaded my mother to lead the whole family, my brother, his family, I, my family. And we went with all the children. At that time, still no grandchildren. In 1993. I'm so pleased that occurred. Since then, every time we have a grandchild who graduates from university or college, we take them to Europe, anywhere they want to go, for as long as they want to go, provided 1 week to spend in Poland with us. And I'm about to go on March of the Living next month.
And Alan, just in line with that, when we were there in a year ago, September, tell about the photograph we saw of the droppage.
Oh, Lord. Lori loves the details. I'm always worried I'm going to keep you here till midnight. So, the place that we were so trying to, in the Nazi headquarters building, that we were trying to stay there, where we never wanted to get flushed out, etc., that was such a safe refuge. Shortly after we left there, that whole section of the building is gone. We saw a photograph. Had that man not gotten out of this, not flushed this out, and by the way, what I'm telling you is we just learned last year. For the previous 74 years, I was blaming this guy for nearly costing us our lives. He saved us. Did not know it. As I said, in the war zone, there are a lot of things you don't know.
The person in the corner.
Well, I'm saving him for last. Anybody else? Because that once I speak to him, that's it, we're done. Yes, ma'am.
So, I've seen probably 3 other Holocaust survivors and listened to their stories. And I must say, you're probably the best adjusted to tell his story out of the bunch.
I've got 2 great wives.
I would just like to thank you for your courage.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
When Alan started, he didn't speak for many years because he was so young and there were older survivors, and the older survivors needed to speak. And it years ago, and it's hard to believe it today, but people would say, you're a child, what did you know? So not alone did the older survivors need to speak, but Alan as a child was disregarded as, what did you know, you were just a child. And now, as the survivors are much, much older, and Alan's about to celebrate next month his 84th birthday, he was this little boy, so imagine how much older the others are. So they spoke, and as they were getting more and more frail, Alan felt it was his obligation. As difficult as that is and was, and just recently, an eighth grader asked him a question that brought him to tears. And that question was?
Well, you know, with repetition, I get used to the pain. But once in a while, a new pain occurs, that I'm not used to, and I respond like any human being with whatever emotion comes up at that time. And here's the question. Nobody asked this before. If you had an opportunity to speak to your parents today, right now, what would you say to them? As I'm speaking to you now, it hurts. How do I say thank you? Thank you for my life. Thank you for my children's life. Thank you for my grandchildren's life. It seems so trite. How do I do that? And I say that to you with tears in my eyes.
And before you deal with that, the other question, the intergenerational trauma is very real.
Honey, people in the back can't see you, so why don't you get up, please?
I am tall. You thought I was real short. Any of you who've served in the military or have had other experiences, there is PTSD. And that gets carried forth to the next generation. And if it's not in one way or another, it is some way. So we are a family of lawyers. Half of us in the family.
I counted today, exactly one half.
And justice and doing the right thing are critical in the lives of each of us and of our children. So there's a carryover that does not stop. Now I'm going to go over to him. Since I've got a microphone, you can speak into the microphone.
To repeat
your somewhere right over here. I'm a spy.
Okay. I'll grab it. I just asked, for those of us who hear you and say there are resonances between then and now, as a room full of future lawyers, what can we do going forward to make sure this never happens again?
Here and the rest of the world.
You want to take it or you want me to take it?
Well, as Alan mentioned, people take different paths. One of them is his brothers. And Connor, who introduced us, spent a summer interning for Alan's brother, which led him to think being a lawyer is important. And what Andy is doing is very rare. And he is making countries financially pay for the harm that they cause. So the sailors on the coal, or a man who was tortured in Cuba. And Andy has gotten laws changed to enable the United States to collect on assets in this country, with the thought being that if it hurts that country enough, they will stop doing it. Southern Poverty Law Center did that with the Ku Klux Klan in one of the southern states. I think teaching our children. Alan started by saying, I just want to add just more. Any of you who do or will have children, telling them when you see something, say something, and do something. Bullying, pushing is the beginning, and it leads to worse things.
Okay, you as lawyers, we as lawyers, we are first of all, we're officers of the court, we're officers of the state. We have an obligation to protect society. I realize that most of us are interested in our own economic well-being, but don't we forget, really and truly, our primary obligation is to serve our society, whether as an elected officer or as a court officer or whatever. When I went to law school, I was taught that was part of my responsibility as a lawyer. I was supposed to be an active member of society. I cannot renege that. I am long retired. I'm still a very active member of my society. You and we, all of us as lawyers, have more control than you can possibly imagine. The mobs on the street, yes, they are threatening, they're dangerous, they can hurt people, they can kill people. But as long as the laws are protecting us, and as long as we, lawyers, insist on the proper functioning of the laws, we will protect this society. There may be occasional incidents here and there, but we have the obligation of protecting society. And we cannot ever forget that obligation. I realize we have to feed our families and all the rest of that stuff, but never for a moment forget that we are the front line of defense of our way of life. As the military is on the battle zone, this is a different battle zone. And we are here, and I'm going to tell you, you are the point guards. And I don't care if you're in corporate law, you are the point guards. We have a son-in-law who is a house counsel, the number one lawyer in the firm, in a business. His job is to say to his bosses, no, you cannot do that. He might get fired for saying no. He understands that. Our job when we see something wrong is not to be passive. Did I answer your question? And what I'm saying to you is you cannot be active enough. When you've done your very best, you've done just enough. Thank you.